Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to listen to us online at commonwealthclub.org. I do want to mention that tonight's event is a Good Lit event underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And now I'll introduce our speaker, Elizabeth Kaler Pentecoff. Elizabeth was born and grew up in rural Wisconsin, but left the Midwest for college in California and has returned only for family visits. She's written 7 books for children and 2 for adults, including the ABCs of Writing for Children, a Writer's Digest book club selection. She's also written hundreds of articles for magazines and newspapers such as Columbia, the San Francisco Chronicle, and Parents Magazine. She's married and lives with her husband in Northern California. And now, join me in welcoming Elizabeth Kaler Pentecoff.
Thank you very much, John. I really appreciate that. Now, some of you may be thinking, well, Rosemary's been part of our world for a long time. She was born in 1918. I was born in 1957. You'll have to do the math there to figure it out. But, you know, why now do I write the book? Why didn't I write it sooner, earlier? Well, when Rosemary was alive, there was always a worry and a concern. We were very protective of Rosie. And anyone who's famous and in the public spotlight knows that there are dangers and risks with being famous. And so we didn't want to draw any attention to where she lived and what her situation was for safety concerns. And it wasn't until a few years ago when I had finished one book project and some articles, and I was kind of figuring out, well, what should I write? Well, I believe in the power of our own dreams. Yes, the dreams that we have at night in nighttime. I've been part of a dream group for over 10 years where we meet and discuss our dreams. And I've been a dream journal person since I don't know when. And I believe that they really have a key to who we are. They kind of connect us to the universe in mysterious ways. So that night when I was wondering about what I should write next, I said as I was getting into bed, send me a dream. Tell me what I should write. Well, I had a dream that very night, and there was a young blonde man who came to me, and he said, you're going to write The Missing Kennedy. And I said, oh, no, I'm not. And he said, why not? And I said, well, I don't want to get Eunice Kennedy Shriver, which was Rosemary's sister, upset or angry, or any of the other Kennedys. And he says, no, they want you to write this book because it's how you're going to write this book. So I woke up. I was rather puzzled, but I thought, all right, I better listen to my subconscious. So I began writing what I remembered about Rosie because I met her when I was a very young girl, and I bonded with her. My aunt took care of Rosemary in her home in southeastern Wisconsin. So I first began writing my own memories and doing research, which meant copious amount of reading, and I was searching articles, and all of a sudden, one day, I saw the picture of the man who I had dreamt about. And I searched, and in the caption it said, he was David Kennedy, the son of Robert Kennedy. Unfortunately, David was alone in a Los Angeles hotel room in 1968, and he witnessed the unfortunate assassination of his father. David suffered from mental illness, and he sought relief through drugs and alcohol. It was very sad. He was in and out of jail many times, and he said to his cousins that he most closely related to his Aunt Rosemary. And they said, why? And he said, Well, if my grandfather Joe had been alive, when I'm alive and having these problems, I think he would want me to have a lobotomy. And when I read that, I thought, you know, okay, maybe there is a connection to us in the universe. So as I wrote this book, I discovered my own connection to mental illness. My family, my mother's sister and sisters, actually three sisters, suffered from mental illness, and her brother, and we were not aware of everything at the time because it was so hidden. So as I started writing about my memories, I found some mysterious ties between Rosie and I that I didn't even know existed. My original title was The Missing Kennedy, a memoir of silence, faith, and transformation. My publisher changed it to the original title that is today, The Missing Kennedy, Rosemary Kennedy, and the Secret Bonds of Four Women. I wasn't thinking properly because, of course, Rosemary's name needs to be in it. The Secret Bonds of Four Women, it relates to myself, Rosie, my aunt sister Paulus, and the most formidable mover and shaker of all, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, her sister. I began, of course, by doing some research at the John F. Kennedy Library and Museum in Boston. I recommend, if at all, you can go to visit presidential museums. They're fabulous. You can learn so much about not only the president, but the administration and what was going on at the time. Now, at a library like this, it's not like a public library. So, yes, you can go in and access papers, but you only can access certain papers through applying and saying what your project is and why you need the information. So it was a bit of a lengthy process, but it was very worthwhile. The librarians were wonderful. There were all sorts of rules about what could be copied, what couldn't be copied, where you placed the paper on the desk, you know, that you removed the paper before putting another paper down, all sorts of different things, and how you handled the documents. I was very thrilled whenever I saw documents or letters to or from my aunt, Sister Paulus, and you will see that this one's blacked out. Well, there were many documents that were blacked out. Think as to what a presidential library should contain. Papers of the president, anything to do with the administration. However, the Kennedys have donated their own personal private papers here. So, you know, really, some people thought, told me, well, wasn't that frustrating? And I said, you know, I think it was a gift that some of these papers were here at all for us to look at, because truly, we do have privacy, you know, and so that they shared whatever they could was generous. I really was touched, and I got tears in my eyes anytime I saw my aunt's familiar handwriting. In this card, she, of course, signed for Rosemary and said, come to see me, so that she would spend time with her daughter. And she did in later years. We visited the John F. Kennedy birthplace, which, of course, was Rosemary's birthplace as well. And the famous scene was in this room. The bed at the far end next to the window was the birthing bed where Mrs. Kennedy was when she gave birth to John, Joe, and Rosemary. You may have heard the familiar story when Rosemary was born. The doctor was late, and the nurse told Mrs. Kennedy to hold her legs shut, and she even prevented the birth. Now, there are reasons for this. Back in those days, they thought doctors were God, and doctors had to be there. The other reason is the doctor wouldn't have gotten paid if he wasn't there. The thinking at the time was, the thinking now, of course, was Rosemary was deprived of oxygen for about 2 hours while she was stuck in the birth canal. When she was born quickly, the family grew to know that she was really kind of developing a lot slower than her older brothers developed. And it wasn't until the end of her second year at kindergarten that school officials called the Kennedys in and said, okay, there's a problem here. We can't advance her to first grade. You need to do something else. This is not working. They sent her to doctors, highly paid doctors, who said Rosemary was mentally retarded, was what they said. Today we'd say she's mentally challenged. Now we know that she was probably learning disabled. I saw much of her math work. She could add three-digit numbers together, three-digit numbers together successfully. She could do lots of higher thinking type things. What she could not do was read or write very well. She switched her letters backwards. She was unable to spell, and reading was very difficult for her. Back at the home, we were able to see the nursery where the children played when they were young, and I could just imagine Rosemary toddling around with her older brothers. Now, I want you to think back to your own life and anyone that you are closely in contact with, whether it be friends, family, a spouse. Have you ever suffered from insomnia, anxiety or depression, schizophrenia, chronic pain, panic attacks, indigestion? Well, hold the antacid. If this were you or your loved one in 1941, you too could have had a lobotomy. They even gave lobotomies to housewives who were bored and didn't want to do the dishes. They gave them to teenagers who were unruly. Truly, it was a very frightening time. Guess what? Our author Ernest Hemingway could have been a candidate for a lobotomy. Princess Diana could have been a candidate. And our own president, Abe Lincoln. Here you'll see my Uncle Nick in the fur cap, along with my father in his winter farm cap, kind of goofing around. Well, Uncle Nick suffered from depression, and we didn't know it because he was able to fake it. He was always happy when I saw him, joking around. We had no knowledge that he had a secret life. He was had depression, but at that time in the 60s when I knew him, you weren't to talk about such things. If you were depressed, well, just snap out of it. That's how everyone dealt. I did not know he suffered from depression until later in his life when he ended it with a bullet. This is my Aunt Zora, vivacious, fun-loving, just a wonderful lady. She didn't suffer from mental illness until her mobster husband, yes, he was in the mob, started abusing her and beating her. She had no out other than to take the children and come back to family in Wisconsin. At that point, she started manipulating all of the family members and lying and stealing and acting in ways that was not like Aunt Zora. Well, many years later, we found out she was schizophrenic. Fortunately, no one suggested she had a lobotomy. Now we have to time travel back to 1941, the time of Rosemary's lobotomy. The whole issue of mental illness was a different situation. They thought back then, they believed some of the medieval things, like that the devil caused mental illness. It could be contagious, there should be ways to get rid of this gene that was around, and we should just get rid of these people. So if you had a family member, if we were around with Aunt Zora at the time, we would have had to hide her in an attic and never say a word, because otherwise my father would have lost his job, people would have ostracized us, and I would have been bullied in school. Patients at the time in mental institutions were, of course, not thrilled to be there, and so they would have be violent or be upset. And what did they do? Often they were chained. They were handcuffed, not for an hour or two, but days or weeks at a time. Straitjackets were common. Again, days or weeks. Treatment included electric shock therapy, which my aunt had several times, and I will say electric shock sometimes can be helpful, but it damages the brain. A lot of patients are never the same after that. Another case of electric shock, insulin coma therapy, which also damaged the brain. And then there was hydrotherapy. Patients were subjected to being in a bathtub with either ice-cold water or hot water, strapped in there days and weeks at a time. It sounds like a medieval torture chamber to me. Now, the occurrence of mental health drastically increased after both world wars, and after any war, they increased. Does anyone want to guess why? PTSD, right, post-traumatic stress disorder. And they, of course, they didn't know what that was. Also, brain injuries. So it was really horrific. People really needed help. There was no money for anybody with mental illness or institutions because everybody thought so lowly of these people. And so, you know, patients were in these fire traps and treated horribly. Criminals often worked at these institutions because they were aides and they could get work there because there was no such thing as a background check. So it was not a pleasant society at all. Meet Dr. Walter Freeman. He was Rosemary's lobotomist. He and his partner, Dr. James Watts. Now, Dr. Freeman was a neurologist, not a surgeon. And he was Yale educated, and he taught at George Washington University. He was the kind of guy who would do an autopsy and hold up the brain in class with blood dripping all over for the theatrical effect. Once he was trying to show dementia, he ushered in an elderly woman, and with no regard for her dignity, he fed her with a baby bottle. The students would actually take their dates to class because he was more entertaining than taking them to a movie. Now, the problem with Dr. Freeman is that he liked to exaggerate his success, and he conveniently forgot about his failures. And he was a publicist for himself. He went to all the major newspapers and magazines, Reader's Digest, Newsweek, Time. They had titles like, "A lobotomy is no worse than removing a tooth." And he didn't believe in the theory of germs. Now, his partner, neurosurgeon Dr. James Watts, didn't agree with him, and eventually they did separate because of this. But he didn't bother with draping patients or, you know, little things like washing his hands. Forget it. So let's meet. Oh, let me show you the lobotomy tool. This is what he used for a lobotomy. Now, what doctors did is the patient was laid out, usually a sandbag under their head, and Rosemary, like many other patients, was awake. And the reason for that is after the surgeons drilled into the prefrontal areas of the brain, they inserted this lovely instrument like a scalpel into those holes, and they asked the patient, like Rosemary, to count or to sing a song. Then they twisted this instrument until the patient could no longer respond. Then they were through. It's shocking, but this was how it was done. Later, Dr. Freeman improved upon this method, and he had a lobotomobile. He was like a carnival barker. He'd drive through neighborhoods. proclaiming what a wonderful invention this was, and anybody could have it in 10 minutes because he perfected it with an ice pick. He placed the ice pick underneath the eyelid here, lifted up, and twisted. 10 minutes, the patients had black and blue eyes. That was it. So it was a very frightening time. Let's meet Rose and Joe Kennedy. Rose was a homemaker, very involved with her 9 children, and also very involved with society and charities. Joe was an investor and a businessman, and he was our ambassador to England in 1938. And indeed, most of the family moved over there, except for the kids who were in colleges. And Rosemary lived in a lovely little English countryside town where she was with the nuns, who were very loving, in a Montessori school where she worked with preschool children and she read them books. She was happy and she was just thrilled to be there because while she lived at home in the United States, she was not really part of her family. Her family embraced her incredibly, and they were so loving toward her. But she could tell that she was different. She'd ask her mom, well, why can Eunice and Pat go out and take a train and visit with friends and go out on a date, and why can't I? Well, Rosie was very naive, and she would have been very easily persuaded by anyone to go off with them. And so keep in mind that this was the era of the Lindbergh kidnapping. In the 1930s, pilot Charles Lindbergh's baby was taken from an upstairs room. The person used a ladder, and of course that baby was not recovered alive. He was killed. So parents of anyone who was rich and famous were terrified of kidnapping. So, of course, Rosemary had a governess with her or a family member with her whenever she went anywhere. She did go dancing with her brothers and family. The brothers made sure, like Jack, would sign her dance card and get all of his friends to sign her dance card, too. So she always danced, but she knew that no one else asked her to dance, and that really bothered her. So the problem was that even though she was happy in England, World War II loomed. And of course we know World War II, England was bombed. So before the bombing, the family had to come home, Rosemary had to come home, and then Rosemary was put in a very strict convent setting. She began acting out. She acted out in the convent setting, and she acted out at home, had violent temper tantrums. She hurt herself and family members. At the time, the doctors said she had agitated depression. I wouldn't be surprised if she truly was bipolar. I know enough about people who were bipolar with my own family members and friends that I believe that that's my best guess. Anyways, they needed to do something with Rosemary. Now, the problem at the time is doctors said, oh, put her in an institution and don't visit her ever. The reason they thought family members should not visit their loved ones was that it would be too much of an emotional upheaval for the patient. Okay. Let's go on to meet Joe. He was the oldest sibling of Rosie, and he joined World War II in the aircraft division, and unfortunately, his plane blew up in a bombing mission in 1944. After that, the Kennedys began the Joseph P. Kennedy Foundation. It began for anyone, to help anyone who was poor, disabled, or needed money. Later, Eunice told the family, we really should concentrate our efforts on everything to help those with mental disabilities. And thanks to Eunice, that's what happened. Of course, we know about Jack Kennedy. He was our 35th president, and had a very loving relationship with Rosie. And there was Rosie, born in 1918. She lived until she was 86 in 2005. There's her younger sister, Kathleen, who was very vivacious. And Kathleen joined the American Red Cross during World War II, and she died in 1948 in a tragic plane accident. Eunice, the mover and the shaker, the sister who was closest to Rosemary all of her life. Then, of course, Pat. Pat was very involved with the theater. Pat married British actor Peter Lawford and had four children, was very involved with campaigning for her three brothers, Bobby, Ted, and Jack. There's Bobby. Bobby Kennedy ran for president after he was a lawyer and he was attorney general during his brother's administration. And of course, we know that Bobby was assassinated in 1968 in Los Angeles at the age of 42. There's Jean, the last surviving member of the Kennedys. She's in her 80s now. She started an organization called Very Special Arts for anyone who was handicapped. And she also did a lot of campaigning and a lot of charity work throughout her life. Ted, known as the Lion of the Senate for 46 years, he's mainly known for his work with healthcare, people with disabilities, the poor, and for peace. And there is the family. You can see Rosemary on this side. She's got her head turned, looking at everyone else, having a great time on the beach. You can see Jack standing on the other side of the picture. He's all in white, kind of standing on his haunches. It must have been very difficult for her to live in that very competitive and athletic family. When she had her lobotomy, I interviewed Joe about this, not Joe, I'm sorry, Anthony Shriver, about her lobotomy, because it was such a tragic thing. I carried around a lot of, I have to say, hate for Joe, and even anger toward Rosemary, her mother, because how could they have done this to her? But Anthony said to me, "We believe the experts in the field recommended this procedure to give her a more peaceful and productive life. Joe had a relentless desire for all of his children to be the best and give them the best. The goal was to enhance her life." Of course, after the tragic lobotomy, everything went wrong. She was bedridden. She was incontinent. She couldn't communicate. She couldn't talk. So she was sent to Craig House. Craig House is in upstate New York, and it's known as the mental institution for the rich and famous. You might recognize the name because Jane Fonda's mother was there in the 50s and unfortunately committed suicide there. Zelda Fitzgerald, author Scott Fitzgerald's wife, stayed there in the 30s. Rosemary was there from 1941 until 1949, when it was discovered she was sexually abused. Remember, I was talking about the criminals. They could be employed in one mental institution, get fired, wander over to the very next town, get rehired by another institution, and nobody was the wiser until something horrific happened. Enter my aunt, Sister Paulus. My aunt, Sister Paulus, was assigned Rosie's care in 1960. Rosie went in 1949 to St. Coletta, and Joe had a special house built for her right on the grounds. It was a ranch-style home. But Joe still lived with the doctor's advice from those long ago years, which said never visit the patient. So he merely told his family and his wife that Rosie had gotten worse and had to be institutionalized. So from 41 until 61, 20 years, she had no visitors, no family members. And the research I did showed she wasn't the only one. There are many people who had the same issue. Even in the early 60s, when a good friend of ours had a nervous breakdown and was put in an institution for a while to recover, her family was not allowed to visit her. And this was in the 60s. It wasn't until Joe had a stroke in December of 61, which ironically robbed him of his communication abilities, and he could no longer talk or walk, that the nuns contacted Joe, but couldn't get a hold of him, so they contacted Rose. That's when Mrs. Kennedy learned the truth. When she found out, she was just aghast and said, "Let Rosemary out. Let her have socialization. Take her to church. Take her to restaurants. Have people visit her." And that's when Mrs. Kennedy went to visit her. And so the very first time she was seen was Rosie and Sister Paulus and another nun went to the airport to get Mrs. Kennedy. And Rosie saw her mother, and it was like one of those dramatic meetings, you know, where you'd think the music would swell, and Mrs. Kennedy opened up her arms and Rosie rushed into them, and then she beat her mother on her chest and screamed this horrific scream as if to say, "Where have you been all my life?" So Rosemary knew. And in fact, we discovered there was a lot more of Rosemary left than anyone really realized. Rosemary was blessed with my aunt. My aunt was the first person who really understood how to treat someone lovingly. So if Rosemary, which was quite common, she might stamp her feet and say, "No," you know, to turning off the television and visiting the bathroom, anybody else would probably yell at her and try to force her to do it. But my aunt knew, and she would just take her hand and calmly pat it and say, "Oh, Rosie, remember the last time you were able to turn off the television all by yourself? I was so proud of you." And soon, Rosie was doing exactly what my aunt asked. So both the product of my aunt and the product of getting her to be in with people again saved her life. And she had a very happy life after that. Now, my aunt also was a product of a large Catholic family. You can see my aunt, who was named Stella, and she has the scalloped blouse at the front. She was one of 10 children, and my father was the youngest in the very front with the white shirt. And so she pretty much raised my father as well as some of the others, because Grandma and Grandpa were busy running the farm. And Grandpa had several field hands, and so Grandma was cooking and doing laundry for all of these field hands. So, you know, her hands were full. Sorry for the bad pun. So Sister Paulus, Stella at this time, was very close to my dad, and hence when my dad grew up, they still had this bond, and so she was closest to me because we visited her all the time. The other people in this picture either had very huge Catholic families, so they were a little bit bound by their families and couldn't see Sister Paulus on a regular basis, and then one of them became a priest in South Dakota. So it was really, we were the closest. Here are the buildings, some of the buildings at St. Coletta. My aunt had to be a Mother Superior for a few years, but throughout the whole time, she always drove Rosemary everywhere, and she was with Rosemary, taking care of her for really over 30 years. There's the school where the children had schooling and the convent, and that's me. I was 4 years old at about this age when I met Rosemary. Rosemary was 43. And you'll see that she's standing outside her ranch house, which was built for her. Rosie was very sweet and loving. As a child, I loved going to St. Coletta. It was such a treat because everyone was so friendly. Everybody with a mental disability was loving and warm, and we got all these hugs, and we would dance and have parties. So it was a great, on Sundays, I really looked forward to it. Rosemary loved visiting people. She came to everyone's house. She came to our house on a regular basis. And her favorite thing, of course, was something I can relate to, dessert and parties. She loved traveling to all of her brothers and sisters' homes. And here she is with Sister Paulus in Hyannisport on the Cape. There, Sister Paulus and Sister Julaine took Rosie to the John F. Kennedy Library and Museum. There she is at the Palm Beach home, and Eunice, her favorite sister, is by her side. And you can't really tell, it's dark up there, but she has this delightful smile and glint in her eye because she knows she's the center of attention, which was as it should be. She loved celebrations, anything colorful like Easter, and she really enjoyed going down memory lane and going through photos of her experiences with Sister Paulus. And here she took a photo of her brother Ted because everyone else was taking pictures. There she is. I believe this was a blouse and a purse given to her by the Kennedys, and she loved it because it was very colorful. She was standing in front of her house, in which there was a huge cornfield. And as one of the reporters who interviewed me said, I stood in that cornfield to take pictures of her and her house. There's a picture inside her house. And the reason I chose this was not only because she loved bright accessories, but you can kind of see it was a regular house, nothing fancy. We had a nice big living room there to visit with her. Behind the chair was the dining area where we had many meals. This kitchen is through the main door. The door behind her chair led to her bedroom, which was a master bedroom with a nice big window in the front. And then there were just a couple of very tiny, sparse rooms for the nuns. The closets had room for, you know, two or three outfits, you know, which were the veil and everything, and a very slim single beds, a Spartan desk, and that was it. The Sisters of St. Francis of Assisi believed in poverty, chastity, and obedience, and my aunt was very proud of that. And there's Anthony playing with Rosemary at his home, and he was very close to his aunt. Imagine a young teen on his own deciding to go out and visit his disabled older aunt at St. Colettas. And that's what he did on a regular basis. So he became bonded with Rosie, and Rosie became bonded with Anthony. Anthony said, I loved her home of St. Coletta. It was a great experience for a young man to sleep in a tiny room with a desk and a chair. It was a calming environment and a refreshing experience. There was a kindness and sweetness of St. Coletta. I went to chapel, met nuns, and broke bread. I grew up in a hectic family with expectation and determination. Life with Rosemary was a gift. He brought her to his home. And through Sister Paulus, Rosemary learned all of the necessary skills like toilet training. She remembered how to swim, and she even dove off the diving board with a big grin on her face. And then she discovered a new skill. One day when Sister Paulus, Rosie, and Sister Delaine appeared at my family's front door, all three were bouncing with excitement. Even my dog Lori wiggled and barked, picking up on their enthusiasm. Sister Julaine and Rosie entered the house first, with Rosie grinning and hopping. Although she typically walked slowly and a bit hunched over, she seemed to be standing straighter, and she was so excited, we thought she was going to leap up and down. Yip, yip! Lori rolled over on her back and kicked her paws in the air. What's going on? Asked my mother. Sister Julaine looked behind her, waiting for Sister Paulus to appear. The screen door opened. Sister Paulus asked, Did you tell them? No, said Sister Julaine. I thought you should. Somebody better. I said, I can't stand the suspense. Rosie read billboards. Mom, Dad, and I gasped. Rosie seemed a foot taller and was bursting with pride. No one moved for a whole minute. Rosie giggled. For no apparent reason, and for the first time ever, Rosie had read aloud all of the large signs lining Highway 16 as she and the nuns drove from Jefferson to my hometown of Oconomowoc, which was more than 20 miles. We treated Rosie like a queen that day. "Rosie, you get to be served first," said my mother. Rosie beamed. "Congratulations, Rosie," I said, hugging her. "I'm so proud of you." After we toasted Rosie with lemonade and Mom's homemade date cake, Sister Paulus opened her purse and pulled out Rosie's greeting cards. Rosie reached for them gratefully, as a child might for a favorite toy. She glowed as she shuffled the cards and then paused to study the picture on each one. The billboard experience motivated my aunt to use flashcards with Rosemary, and she was successful in teaching her to read simple words in children's books. Now, through the process of writing this book, I may have mentioned, I found myself crying. And it was a very traumatic thing to write a book when you feel like you are Rosie. Plus, I had to relive a lot of difficult emotions from when my family suffered from mental illness. I was very angry, like I said, with Rosemary, Mrs. Kennedy, and Mr. Kennedy. But I came to accept that they did what they had to do at the time, and look at the positive actions that resulted from one woman. There's Special Olympics, which Eunice started in her backyard, and in 1968 grew to be a huge organization. They have served millions of people over time. There's Best Buddies. Anthony started this when he was only in high school, and that pairs able-bodied students with mentally challenged students, and now it has spread to colleges. And Rosemary was just influenced my life in many ways, and so did my aunt, Sister Paulus. She was tremendous in loving as well as Sister Paulus, and that's how I try to approach this book. Let's make it our turn now. The Kennedys and Rosemary really started a revolution for everyone who is disabled. Well, now let's turn to the issue of mental health. The Kennedys are now revealing that, yes, Rosemary had a mental illness. And you know what? We can change and we can start helping everyone. In the 1970s, our institutions, which probably rightly so, closed. Some of them were terrible places. However, what was supposed to happen in the 70s, which Rosalind Carter worked very hard for, was that we were supposed to be regulating, helping people through our individual communities with community health centers. Unfortunately, along came the 80s and the Me Generation. Suddenly, we don't care about anybody who's not us, and their money was gone. And now, our major institution for the mentally ill is prison. The other place, of course, look out on the streets. 1 in 3 homeless people have an undiagnosed and an untreated mental illness. In fact, 1 in 4 of adults everywhere will suffer from a mental illness in a given year. So we need to spread the word that it's okay. Mental illness is a disease. It's not our fault. Send a card to somebody you know. Try to treat someone with kindness. And don't forget your own mental health. Exercise. Eat right. Talk to trusted friends and relatives. Write in a journal. Be thankful. Gratitude every day can help our own emotions. And do a small kindness every day for someone. And of course, nature. What other better way to cheer anyone up is to be out in nature. I'm a tree hugger. I admit it. I'm sorry, but it makes me happy. Let's treat everyone with respect and dignity that they deserve. You know, find a passion. Read a book. I know that's such an odd thing to say in these days. We're always on our devices. But you know what? Read a book. You'll be happy that you've done that. And if you or a loved one are suffering, contact the National Alliance of Mental Illness through their 800 number or their website. Most of all, write your story. You might say, why me? No one will care. You know what? You should be writing it for family history. You should be writing it for you. And all of a sudden, as we write our stories, we discover truths that we never knew we had and how we grew and changed. Most of all, remember Rosie. And thank you very much. We can take questions if we have some.
Thank you, Elizabeth. We'd like to remind our listening audience this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Elizabeth Kaler Pentecoff speaking on her book, The Missing Kennedy. Now, I know there are questions. So if a person has a question, please raise your hand. We have a mic so you can be heard.
Yes, thank you. It seems that the diagnosis was a little unclear, and that there may have been two issues, absolutely, oxygen deprivation and some type of mood disorder, maybe bipolar. What do psychiatrists say now, looking back? Is there any clarity? Were there two things or
yes,
more going on?
Yes, there were two things going on, and had we known more about it at the time, they would have been able to teach her in a regular school, teaching disabled students. Children, it's just basically different modalities. You know, if she was truly reading disabled, you know, what I did when I was a teacher was, you know, we had audio for the students so that they could hear the stories. Testing was different. Testing isn't done with a pencil and a paper, but with an aide so that the aide can read the question and then they can hear it. And they process differently. They process auditory, not visually. So I think had Rosemary been born today, she would have had a completely different life. But you are right. There were two diagnoses. Most books will admit the first. Most books don't really mention the second diagnosis. I am very happy that Patrick Kennedy has a book out where he does say his aunt Rosemary had mental illness, and he's being very vocal about the cause of mental illness.
Hi. The man in your dream, David?
Yes.
Was he part of your research, and did he help with this?
I believe that he pushed me in the right direction. You know, I just thought it was some guy telling me to write this book until I saw his picture and I realized he was a real person. And then later when I read the anecdote about how he felt, I just felt like this was the universe saying, okay, it's time to tell the story about mental illness.
Thank you.
Excellent question.
Thank you very much for writing this book. You know, same stories, you know, suicide, alcoholism. And there are a couple of things. There recently, Tab Hunter, there's a movie out, and he was an advocate in the 1950s on television, and it's on YouTube.
Oh,
I invite
it.
People
you.
To look at it.
Excellent.
Because his mother was mentally ill, and he was the biggest box star in the late 50s, so this carried some weight when he went on TV.
He was brave to do it.
Right. And then the other component is, you know, there were unintended consequences of closing these mental institutions and putting people in the old folks' homes. And my grandmother, you know, three suicide attempts. She was in Kings Point, you know, on Long Island.
Wow.
And they closed the institution, and she was in there for 22 years. And within 3 weeks, she had suicided because she wasn't. They put her in an old folks' home. Her capital was gone. It was upper middle class wealth, not intergenerational. So her money's gone. She ends up in an institution. She doesn't show up, and she drowned herself. And that's where, when you're talking about anger, this totally impacted our family life.
Absolutely.
And my mother would say, well, if anybody asks, your grandmother lives in an apartment in New York.
Exactly. And that was the line that I was, you know, you're never to meant, I was told, you do not say your aunt's name. So, you know, we socialized with the other side of the family, the Kalers, and we'd be, you know, and I would have to really be careful what I said on two accounts. One, they were a very conservative family. My aunt was actually quite liberal in her Catholic views and accepting, but several of the other members were not. And so I would be, you know, I'd start to say something and my mother would shoot me a look. And it wasn't my mother's fault. My mother would be berated afterwards because she was raising me wrong if something like that had gotten out. So I was learned. When I was doing the book, I was talking to my cousin Mary Kaler, and I said, well, you know, I'm writing about my Aunt Zora. And she said, you had an Aunt Zora? That's a name I never heard of. I went, that's right, because you weren't supposed to hear of it. And it was like just a couple of years ago that I talked to my own, the other side of the family about mental illness. And of course, I've discovered that on the other side of the family, guess what? It's a very big issue today. It's staring us in the face, and we really need to accept it and embrace it. Over here, Bob.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just curious about one thing. You mentioned that she had trouble reading and that she would print some of her letters backwards. That sounds like dyslexia. Is that another possibility here?
That is what they think, yes, that she truly was not perhaps retarded, as they say, where it's a lower than 70 IQ or something like that. But in fact, it was learning disabled, which means she could have just been taught differently. Yes.
I was curious about the lobotomy, if you know the details of the lobotomy, as well as what the history in the medical literature was about lobotomies at that time.
Well, what was known in popular culture was what I told you. I kind of gave you a little brief overview of the actual lobotomy. You know, other lobotomies that happened, I can tell you about those. You know, there are people in society today that actually can tell you about their lobotomies. There's a man who lives in San Jose, and he drives a bus, and he is able to drive a bus, thank God. But he was a teenager when his stepmother married his father, and the stepmother did not have a good relationship with him. So his father was kind of milquetoast about it, so the stepmother just took him to Dr. Freeman. Yeah. It ruined his life. And so he lived for many years, you know, alcohol, drugs, everything, to try to deal with this lobotomy. And it wasn't until he was middle life that he actually kind of started getting his life together. And now he's happily married, and he's a bus driver. He's a productive member of society. You know, he's a survivor. People have contacted me after I'd done the book through emails, and sometimes I've talked on the phone with them, and it's like these horror stories that happened to their parents and their family members. So I think the lobotomy was done, you know, it was just too easy, and doctors were gods. So today, if you get a diagnosis, I don't care if it's a, you know, ingrown toenail, if it's something serious with a serious complication, make sure you seek a second and maybe a third opinion, and you read books about it on the subject yourself.
Hi.
Hi.
Sorry, my voice is a little shaky.
That's okay.
I had a question. I was curious. It seems like instead of lobotomies, that since the 70s and 80s, the quick fix now is antidepressants.
You bet. And Thorazine.
Well,
you're drugged to out of it.
Yeah, and I recently read an article, and it seems very similar to them putting people in the institutions where it was almost a self-fulfilling prophecy that if they were not mentally ill when they went in, they certainly were
when they came out.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And the article that I just read regarding the use of these antidepressants was that they're finding that if you use them for a long enough period of time, say 16, 20 years, you will be
depressed. Yeah.
If you were not depressed when you started using them, you are definitely going to be having the symptoms of it if you try to go off of them or you're on them for any length of time.
Imagine, yes. I think
seems like a quick fix.
Absolutely.
Kind of thing.
So it's a difficult
to this generation.
You know, and that's the problem with mental illness is that sometimes it waxes and wanes. Sometimes my aunt was all right and she could actually hold a job and she could be okay. And then whatever would flip her off and turn around. So, you know, I don't know enough about mental illness. I'm not a doctor, but certainly it sounds like there are a lot of resources like, you know, okay, maybe drugs are not only the answer. You know, maybe they need to be stabilized and then maybe there can be a psychiatrist brought in. But you're right. I think there's a lot of overdrugging in America. Thank you so much for the excellent questions.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. We've passed our final question. Our thanks to Elizabeth Kaler Pandikoff, author of The Missing Kennedy, for her comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 114th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.